Houdini invited the audience to seal into envelopes questions they wanted answered from the spirit world. When Theodore Roosevelt began to write his question with the paper in the palm of his hand, Houdini took an atlas from the ship's library and offered it to him as a support. Thinking that composer Victor Herbert was onto the ruse, the magician gave him a wink. "Turn around," Herbert told Roosevelt. "He'll discern what you write from the movement of the pencil." After Houdini had collected all the questions, he said, "I'm sure there will be no objection if we use the colonel's question." The audience readily agreed. He had Roosevelt place the sealed question between two blank slates and asked him what his question had been. "Where was I last Christmas?" the colonel replied. Houdini opened the slates and held them up for all to see. One slate had a detailed map in colored chalk of Brazil's River of Doubt in the Amazon. The other slate contained the message "Near the Andes" and was signed by W.T. Stead, a spiritualist journalist who had drowned when the Titanic sank. The next morning, when Roosevelt asked Houdini if the whole thing had been spiritualism or sleight of hand, the magician confided, "It was hocus pocus." Well, it may have been hocus pocus, but somehow the great Houdini accomplished that hocus pocus time and time again, right under the noses of some very sophisticated people. What was there about the early years of the 20th century that enabled Houdini to become so successful? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
How did the Wisconsin native become the most famous illusionist in the world? After nearly 100 years, are there any of his illusions or escapes that remain mysterious? And what became of Houdini's interest in spiritualism? Our guest is Lauren Croyes, professor of art history at the UW-Madison and author of the upcoming book, Creative Composite, Modernism, Race, and the Stieglitz Circle.
And welcome to University of the Year.
Thanks so much for having me.
Houdini seems to me to be one of the most famous names of the 20th century, I would say. Wouldn't you agree?
I think that is entirely accurate. And his career has a lot of different parts. The spiritualism that you alluded to kind of comes at the end, but is something that we also know him for, in addition to his death-defying escapes, which I hope we get a chance to talk about.
There was some illusion involved, even with where he was born for a while. It seems to have finally have settled, though.
It seems that he was born in Budapest, so he's not actually a Wisconsin native, even though he talks repeatedly about having been born in Appleton, Wisconsin. And that's where his family relocates when he's probably around 6. There's also some uncertainty about the actual year that he was born, whether it's 1874, or whether it's a little bit later or earlier, depending on which era of Houdini we're talking about. He changes his birth date.
And his name as well.
And his name as well. Yeah, he's born Eric Weiss in Budapest, as I said, and his dad's a rabbi. And so they leave. There's a lot of anti-Semitism at this time, and they leave and come to Appleton, Wisconsin, where his dad gets a job as the rabbi for a small Jewish population in Appleton.
And what do you think his background as an immigrant and as a Jew, what difference did that make to the kind of approach he took to life, to the whole emphasis on escape artists and so on?
Yeah, it seems to make, I would say, kind of a changing difference across his career. He experiences being Jewish, I think, at certain times quite differently in his life. He goes to Russia, for example, and performs at the height of the pogroms there and really experiences this as something that's very negative about the Russian culture, that they can do this to their Jews. But for the most part, I think with that name change, he tries in some ways not to think about it, not to bring himself forward necessarily as Jewish, although he's always very upfront with his Jewish identity. I'd say, too, that there's a sense in which as an immigrant, he becomes a symbol for lots of other immigrants because his family leaves Appleton when the congregation in Wisconsin decides that they'd like someone who speaks English. His father only speaks German. So they, Houdini, along with his family, moves to New York, where they join a much larger immigrant population. And when he starts performing at Coney Island, Houdini, I think his escapes are, as you say, seen as a kind of almost metaphor for the escapes that other people during this progressive era can possibly have, whether it's immigrants, whether it's African Americans in the South, whether it's people moving from rural environments into the city. There's a lot of this narrative about self-liberation during this period, which Houdini is a great example of.
Mm-hmm. Think of, you know, so many children with their magic kits when they're 7, 8 years old. Did Houdini ever go through that phase, or did he just kind of jump full-fledged into the whole escapist thing?
This is another thing that he tells a lot of different stories about. So he'll tell a wide variety of stories about how he became interested in magic. One of them is that he was locked inside a closet by his parents, and he really wanted to get out, so he had to figure out how to pick the lock. Throughout his whole life, he talks about being obsessed by the way that locks work and being able to sort of photographically memorize their structure. He also talks about his mom locking away pies in a pie safe, but he really wanted the pies, so he learned how to unlock locks. And he also reportedly runs away from home to join the circus when he's a young child. So I think, yes, interested in this idea of being able to get at anything he wants from a very early age.
He was an accomplished athlete, though, even as a teenager.
Yeah, definitely. And that's something that he's proud of throughout his life. And that's also something that enables him to do his magic, quote unquote, is his tremendous physical ability. He's only 5'5", but he becomes a very decorated runner in New York. He works on, like, speed work and endurance work. He's also an extremely accomplished swimmer.
Did he have models? In other words, were there Houdini-like people that he observed where he thought, gosh, I could do that?
There are these great examples of magicians. He, of course, takes his name from Robert Houdini, who's a very famous magician. But then towards the middle of his life, he begins to try to cut all previous magicians down to size. So he writes a book unmasking Robert Houdini, saying about how Houdini stole his tricks. So I think that he, at the beginning, has models, whether they be itinerant magicians or famous magicians like Robert Houdini. But in the middle of his career, he begins to disavow them all, to pull them down so that he can be the one great magician.
I suppose it's hard to tell what's truth and what's myth if you've got a trickster of a figure, as Houdini was, telling you about his life.
Yeah, when he starts to research spiritualism, he says that it takes a flim-flammer to catch a flim-flammer. But he is really interested in facts about magic. He amasses an amazing collection of playbills and books about magic, as well as a collection of theatrical memorabilia as well. So he's interested in the truth, but maybe doesn't always tell exactly the truth, often the truth that's most advantageous.
Show business is not founded on truth, let's
face
it.
Precisely. And he was a master showman. I would say that's even more than, or as much as a master illusionist, he really knew how to sell a trick.
And does he start with then escape as his mainstay?
Yeah, that becomes the thing that gets him out of the dime store museum circuit. So one of his early tricks is putting a bunch of needles in his mouth, chewing them up, and then spitting them out threaded, whole and
oh, yeah.
Threaded.
People still do that,
don't they? Yeah, so that's a pretty common trick.
Okay.
But you can imagine
how.
There's a lot of magician ethics. You're not supposed to give away tricks. So this is a trick that people still do.
Some of them are kind of public domain.
Yeah, exactly. He was really interested in being able to hold things in his throat.
Like keys.
Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. So to not swallow. And that's part of mm-hmm. that trick. But he would have people come and like inspect his mouth to make sure that he was doing it correctly, that it was actually happening. So there's this whole thing about seeing and believing that I think Houdini's playing with. But you can imagine that trick, the seeing has to operate on this really intimate setting.
Right,
it's not a spectacular
not a crowd
trick.
Pleaser, no.
So it works really well in a small environment. When he starts to break out and become a big magician is when he does these escapes. So when he begins to, the first one is a trunk that he and his wife will exchange places within. And then he also gets probably most famous for his handcuff escapes.
Sure, mm-hmm. yes. Well, I mean, so with the trunks, mm-hmm. who is providing the trunk in these escapes that he makes? I mean, obviously, if he provides it, he's got a little leg up there. But the handcuffs, I mean, later on, those are always provided by somebody else, right?
Yeah, so he actually does bring his own handcuffs sometimes. But what makes the handcuff trick circulate so widely exactly is that people would bring their own handcuffs for him to try to break out of. So handcuffs that they'd been working on for like 10 years,
different interlocking. Right, that notorious London case. Yeah, mm-hmm. right.
And all that he required for the handcuffs was that they be able to open and close. Because sometimes he would get handcuffs that were jammed or that he would claim were jammed.
I was going to ask, did he have close calls?
Or failures?
Where he didn't quite pull it off or got that close to not pulling it off?
Yeah, definitely. I think there's a variety. I've heard that sometimes he was, he also does a milk can escape.
Right.
And he would allow local brewers to fill it with beer instead of water, and that might cause a pocket at the top to be full, not of oxygen, which he was expecting, but full of carbon dioxide. So but it's interesting because he also plays up his near-death experiences,
so it's never quite clear.
Because then it's more exciting.
Because
you don't know for sure mm-hmm. that he's going to make it every time. I want to ask you about this wife, what's known about her, because I'm thinking of the proposal here. Will you marry me and be my partner in magic acts and get locked into trunks?
Was Bess in show biz before she
Yeah, they met. She was a song and dance girl.
But there's a
Coney
jump
Island.
From song and dance to magic, right?
Yeah, I think so. She never does the dangerous stuff. And they work on the metamorphosis trunk together, which is an illusion where she's his assistant. She locks him in a trunk, and then they switch places. So when the trunk is open, she's in the trunk, sometimes wearing his clothing. she was even smaller than Houdini. She's, I think, 4 feet something. So that they, scholars of Houdini, speculate that that made it much easier for them to exchange places because they're both so small and sort of acrobatic
in a
certain way.
Yeah, if they're dealing with kind of props designed for people of average size, they'd have some advantage.
Yeah, yes. But I think she loves him and goes along with this. She displaces another guy that Houdini is working with at this point. They're called the Brothers Houdini, but Bess takes that place and they become just the Houdinis. And she's with him for his entire life. They marry after, I think they just know each other for like 3 weeks after they've met on Coney Island.
Well, another
and they get
magic
married.
Trick.
Yeah, exactly.
How much was money a factor? In other words, after Houdini's father died and after, you know, when he's trying to sort of make his way, how much of his foray into this area was a desire to make money?
I think a lot of it. Yeah. Definitely. His father was not wealthy. After he leaves Wisconsin, he becomes sort of an itinerant rabbi in New York, but then goes to work at a clothing factory. Houdini's also working in the garment industry, which is quite common for especially Eastern and Southern European immigrants in New York during this period. So I think to try to break out from that and have a career where he could be like his own boss, that he could put his great physical achievements, this running and this swimming, to use in show business to make money.
So does he have a breakthrough moment?
He does. He gets picked up by a theatrical promoter whose last name is Beck. And this is in the late 1880s. And he gets, because of his handcuff escapes, he gets put on an entirely different
circuit.
Yeah, different mm-hmm. circuit. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So he gets out of those dime museums and moves on to more theatrical performances. And then the year after goes to London, goes to England and does a European tour.
And how would it be billed? Like if you look at the posters from those shows now, what is he being billed as?
I think the Great Houdini, also handcuff, the Handcuff King, is what he becomes known as.
And how's he doing these tricks? I mean, in terms of what the audience sees.
That's interesting because his early performances are done behind what's called a ghost house, which is kind of basically a screen that would go in front of him so that he would be doing this stuff, be escaping from handcuffs behind this screen. So he'd make lots of noise, lots of banging around. Sometimes he would come back out and say, I can't get this one. Can you, like, open it and then put it back on? So there was a variety of drama, but all going on behind the screen. That's true for the milk can escapes,
Why
too.
The screen? Is that necessary for some kind of trickery, or is it?
I think so. I mean, that's also, it's necessary in a way to preserve the mystery, because he had a wide variety of ways that he would get out of handcuffs. As you said, sometimes he holds the key in his throat or in other bodily orifices, let's say, and then brings it back up and is able to get himself out with the key because most of the handcuffs all use the same key. But other times he would just slip it over his wrist.
He was double jointed galore, was he not?
Or
at least very flexible.
It's also a myth that he spread about himself. So
oh,
he would
really?
Talk about for the straitjacket escape, he'd say that you had to be able to dislocate your shoulder.
Yeah, which is very painful for most people.
Yeah, and it turns out that too, what was impressive or what he's able to do is expand his chest a lot to be able to get slack because he's such a conditioned athlete. That
horses
he can
do that all the time when you're tightening the girth.
Works maybe
for
that's
them.
Where he learned it from in Appleton.
And what would he do to make it more of an event? In other words, would there be music? Would there be any kind of – or is it just people watching someone try to get out of handcuffs?
No, I mean, he's part of a – there are also other acts that are performing with him. So he – that's actually a good question because you can think it's not that exciting to just watch somebody try to pull handcuffs off their arms. He drummed up interest by – often when he would first get to a town, he would perform in the police station. So he would break out of the police station's jail.
Plenty of handcuffs there,
exactly.
Too.
And then that was sort of, you know, we all know that the handcuffs of the police are supposed to hold you. So by being able to do that, he was able to drum up this interest in how is he doing this? What's his commentary on the police? Is he making fools of them? What exactly is happening here? And then when he would get to the stage, there was part of that excitement about him already in the air of whatever town he was in. He'd also take handcuffs from the audience so the audience could put the handcuffs on him.
Uh-huh.
This is a period, too, interestingly, before the kind of handcuffs that we think of are in wide circulation. So it's not mostly the handcuffs aren't adjustable. So it tends to be
maybe a little loose for some
sides.
People
yeah.
anyway,
mm-hmm.
especially for somebody of fairly small stature like
mm-hmm,
Houdini.
Mm-hmm.
And did he wear costumes while he's doing this? And did he talk as part of it, or was it always silent?
Oh, yeah. No, he has amazing patter. And that's actually, I think, why we know Houdini, because he is an amazing showman. Other people had escaped from handcuffs before and since, but Houdini's able to make a whole story about it, to make it a personal challenge. He offers people money if they can escape from the handcuffs that he has. He builds this enormous handcuff collection. He also doesn't wear a costume, which is important. He wears, like, evening clothing rather than dressing up like Merlin or what we might think of as a kind of fairy tale image of a magician, which people are doing at that time. And Houdini sets himself apart by making himself a modern magician, by not wearing flowing clothing.
And he eschews the whole supernatural trappings that were used as marketing by some of the competition.
Exactly, yeah.
And what in the era do you think especially made it ripe for a magician, for an escape artist?
I think, like we were talking before, there are a lot of people who are interested in thinking about what constitutes freedom and what constitutes escape from the poor conditions that they find themselves in. There's also a real interest in this period in the difference between truth and what you see, so between appearance and what's the actual reality, between illusion and actuality, which is what's particularly interesting to me as an art historian. This is a moment where there are a lot of spirit photography.
Right. Yes.
It's also a moment of burgeoning mass media, so you get a lot of advertisers that are promising these amazing results that they even have before and after pictures. But what constitutes truth and what constitutes illusion is really up for grabs in this moment.
We'll follow Houdini into the world of films and increasingly difficult illusions and escapes when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Lauren Croys, who is telling us about the life, the career, and the illusions of the great Houdini. We mentioned this ghost screen behind which he did some of his escapes, the handcuff escapes, and the milk can escape, which sounds, you know, very artistic. It almost sounds like shadow dancing as you're watching him. But after a while, did he have to kind of put his cards on the table, so to speak, and let people see more of what he was doing? I mean, did they get tired of that? Gee, what's going on behind the screen?
Yeah, I mean, he continues to use the ghost screen, but it's, or the ghost house, but it's definitely the case that with later escapes, he moves much more into the public eye. It becomes a way to show that it's not a trick, but it rather is this almost like endurance, this physicality.
It's a different
that he's
thing,
able,
isn't it? Yeah. It's not magic anymore. It's, as you say, it's a more of an athletic thing.
Mm-hmm. It's skill.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's a way that he was able to convince people that his illusions were true in this kind of operation between hocus pocus and physical skill. He's coming down on the side of skill when he starts to do, for example, the straitjacket escapes. He would go into a town and get himself suspended upside down from a crane in a straitjacket. Usually in front of the newspaper of whatever town.
Sure. Of course.
So yes. They could just, the photographer could just lean out and take a picture and the reporters could just like open their windows and look at him and write the story. So it was a great way to get coverage. But he had crowds that would be around him watching him struggle to escape from this straitjacket. And it seemingly hanging upside down made it so much more difficult. It actually allowed him to get more slack in the straitjacket by elongating his body. So it was a strategic decision as well.
But who's paying if they're all watching out windows and you know, how is this profitable?
So just an advertisement for the rest of the act?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's
this
a master
just a come
showman.
On.
Yeah, it's just a come on so that everybody would know that he was in town. Everybody would know what he could do. And then they would come into the theater to see the other escapes that he could do, or to see those escapes, or to see even the straitjacket escape closer up so that they could see
sure.
what they were missing, because it's unbelievable as you see it. And I think it's that play between seeing and believing, how Houdini's able to make those two go out of equivalence, that was so provocative about his work.
And we seem to always love that sort of how did he do that factor, you know, even when you said that he would have needles and they'd come out threaded, and I immediately want to know, you know, how, you know, how did that happen? And I guess it's that part, leaving people guessing.
Mm-hmm. And he actually had to, although he got in a lot of trouble for this, occasionally he would give secrets away. He wrote a variety of books about handcuff escapes. And partially he said that he was spreading the knowledge so that other people wouldn't be able to rip him off, so that people wouldn't be convinced by the charlatans who were trying to be the new Houdini. Part of it was also so that he could prove that it wasn't hocus pocus, or that it wasn't him bribing people, which he also did, but he was trying to claim that he never bribed any police officer to let him out of the jail or something. So yeah, that there's this interest in how did he do it, which he's very careful to give some things away, but also keep some things extremely close.
And he had then, he still must have had a lot of competitors if he's kind of heading them off at the pass with these books, explaining how they do it.
I think he loved that competition, though. Like, he even sets his younger brother up as Hardeen.
Right, right.
And then has these huge fights with his brother in the press to drum up interest.
So that
in
was
both
all,
their
that
acts.
Was all trumped up?
I think so. I mean, some magicians he really did dislike, and some, especially magicians who were convinced by spiritualism later, he had no patience for. But for the most part, I think his feud with his brother was, at least his public feud with his brother, was largely a matter of marketing.
Yeah, that was a time, I mean, a little bit later, you get into the, like, 30s on radio, for example, those feuds were not with Houdini, obviously, but with, his famous one between Jack Benny and Fred Allen. It was totally, you know, trumped up.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure it generated a lot of business, a lot of attention.
How is he being covered in the media
during this period?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's having these escapes in front of newspapers, so the newspapers are covering him. In the teens, he's known mostly for his escapes. As we get into the 20s, he turns over this new leaf of going out to get spiritualist and spiritualism. So then he begins to be covered for that, for his desire to debunk beliefs in mesmerists and mediums.
And he also does some things back. Meanwhile, back in the escapes, though, he also occasionally gets himself buried alive.
That was one of his last escapes. Yeah, he got buried alive. He was trying to, when he's most successful, he does an early buried alive stunt that doesn't work out so well, that he has to get unburied very quickly. But he does a more successful version in the 20s, towards the end of his life. He's trying to prove this other he's trying to outdo this other magician who has been buried alive for an hour and 15 minutes, I want to say. And Houdini thinks that he can do better. He thinks that he can do this. And this guy is being seen as sort of magical and death-defying and immortal. The magician that he's up against is Egyptian, and talking about the Egyptian secrets of the occult. So that just puts Houdini, it makes him very upset, puts him on edge. So he decides that he's going to do this escape. And I think he actually believes that it's going to be a lot, well, not an escape, it's just to stay in the box. He thinks it's going to be a lot harder than it actually is, because he ends up getting himself put in a coffin and submerged in a pool.
Yeah,
and,
literally a swimming pool.
Yeah, a swimming pool at the Sheldon Hotel in New York. And he is able, just with controlled breath, to be able to stay in the box for an hour, almost an hour and a half.
So now that he could hold his breath for something like 3 minutes,
yeah,
for starters.
I'm sure that helped.
Yeah, especially earlier in his career, he holds his breath under ice water to be in training for his milk can escapes and his upside down water torture cell escape, which we haven't really talked about.
He has the Chinese water torture cabinet. How did that one work?
He calls it the upside down. It's one of the few that he actually had made. So for the most part, Houdini's using props that we recognize, things like the milk can, which is just a slightly scaled up version of what was used to for milk to travel around to ship milk. And he's also using things like luggage crates. But he builds this upside down, which has a clear front so that you can see Houdini dropped into it. And he's dropped in again upside down. His feet are held, and then he has to get himself free and get himself out.
I've seen pictures too where he's got chains around him and, you know, just different kinds of things that he wraps himself with.
Yeah, I think that's definitely part of the showmanship and part of the buildup is like wrapping himself in chains. He'll later say that any rope or any chain, if it's long enough, there'll always be some play in it so that you can always, when he's trying to debunk a spiritualist, ties them with a bunch of really small lengths of rope because he thinks that makes it much more difficult to get free than it does to curl rope around someone. So, yeah, you can imagine that on stage, the getting into the chains was a large part of the act and to get all the locks fastened, for example.
It's kind of intriguing that, I mean, he did go into films. Now, on the one hand, you could say, as an audience member, well, this obviously, how can I trust this trick? Because it could be trick photography. And the 20s just loved in those silent films to do, I mean, the novelty of trick photography was irresistible. But he did make a foray into films.
Yeah, this is towards the end of his life in the 20s. He's trying to – all these escapes are actually really hard on his body because, as we talked about, he's an endurance athlete. But he's compressing. He's wiggling. He never quite knows what kinds of handcuffs people are going to bring him. So he's, like, dislocating parts of his hands. He's got major bruises. He breaks his feet quite frequently, and then he can't do the upside down and other aspects of his stage show. So he decides that he's going to try to break into film, I think partially because it'll be a little bit easier. It turns out to be much more difficult. He has a hard time figuring out how to act. Eventually, he's quite self-conscious of this and says that you have to study yourself in a mirror from all different angles. You have to know exactly where the camera is so that you can know
silent
what you're acting
films,
to.
Of course.
Yeah, and it's really quite different than his stage show where he's used to being seen from all sides and being able
pattern.
To have this pattern. Yeah, so he ends up not film isn't the out from the stage show that he initially thinks it's going to be. He ends up losing a lot of money in a variety of different production companies that he sets up.
Did he have any kind of educational background that gave him sort of knowledge of physics and of sort of the science behind some of what he was doing?
No, he was super self-conscious about not having any educational background. He, in his letters, he has horrible spelling, really poor grammar, so he often gets ghostwriters for these books that he writes and, as I said, collects all this theatrical memorabilia, lots of books. He's trying to create this library that will make up for his lack of book learning, as it were. I mean, obviously, he creates these amazing illusions, so he has some sort of intuitive or self-taught understanding of the way that he can fool people or the way that he can create these illusions, but he didn't learn it in school.
It was just all hands-on.
What do you suppose was the appeal to him of aviation? Of course, everybody was fascinated by airplanes in the teens and 20s, but what do you suppose appealed to Houdini in particular?
I think it's similar, actually, to the question about whether he learned his knowledge in books or whether he went to school, because he's his father's a rabbi and has a lot of books. I think Houdini respects that and feels like he's not living up to that by just being a magician. So he gets extremely interested in flight because it is this kind of more respectable avenue, perhaps.
Pursuit.
Yeah, and that he could be – he could have a marker of fame that wasn't tied to the kind of disreputable magic. So he tries to become the first person to fly a plane in Australia, for example, a sort of footnote, strange, odd footnote in his career.
What was his personality like when he wasn't on stage?
People say that he was really guarded, that he was extremely private about his private life. He used to write Bess, his wife, little notes, love notes that he would just leave around their apartment, his whole, or their house, I should say, their whole more than 30-year marriage. So he was quite affectionate and doting on her. He also really, really loved his mom. So even after his mother, Cecilia, dies, he still, he has this great mourning for her. And visits her grave, buys her an amazingly large headstone and monument at their gravesite. So he talks a lot about the women in his life, both his mother and Bess. Yeah, I think he's much more – I was surprised to find him so much more private and reserved, relatively faithful. It's possible that he had some affairs, but he seems to have stuck with Bess the whole time.
Or either that he was good at escaping.
Yeah, this is also
not getting caught.
He's extremely competitive, though, and extremely combative, which is both in that in his sports training, and then also later when he tries to debunk magicians who are using their magic to claim that they're in contact with the occult. He doesn't like people trying to cheat.
But he's also competing with himself, isn't he? He has to outdo the last stunt.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Both, I think. You're right that it's both for himself and then also for the audience, always trying to come up with a stunt that will be more impressive, or always trying to figure out how someone else, if they seem to be having more success, how they're doing that. And he even compares himself. He becomes friends with Arthur Conan Doyle.
Oh, yeah.
And he goes to talks by Arthur Conan Doyle, and he tries to, like, assess whether the theater is full and whether it's as full as it was when Houdini was performing there. So he's competitive even with not other magicians, but just with other theatrical personalities in
Doyle
general.
Doyle was quite interested in spiritualism, though. I mean, he was a believer, was he not?
Exactly. That's what leads to the fallout in their relationship, and I think is also largely what gets Houdini so invested in unmasking spiritualists.
And was there a sort of a downside of the fame that was starting to be associated with him?
I don't know if he, like, I don't know if he had another vision for the way that his life could be. He found himself extremely successful, and I don't think he ever really mourned for not having a private life, to my knowledge. I think it was a loss to him that he and Bess couldn't have children together. That was something that I think was a regret, but I don't think that was really tied to the theatrical. I think there was sort of a sadness or regret that he was identified as a magician in so many people's minds, or an illusionist. He really wanted to be known as, like, an inventor or an actor, so that he was at some level looking for a more respectable profession, we could say. Sometimes people would call him an itinerant magician, and he would get so upset, or an itinerant illusionist. He really wanted his wealth, which he was still always concerned about having enough money, but he wanted that to be able to speak to this larger respectability.
Sort of a performance artist,
yeah.
Rather than just a cheap magician with rabbits coming out of a hat.
Right, or like an actor. I think he really wanted to be like a thespian. He wanted to be still with the stage, but with a respectable imprimatur on him or something.
Do we actually have recordings of his voice?
You know, I'm not sure. I think so. Yeah.
But probably not very many.
Yeah, apparently. And I've not heard them. He's much more What's much more visible, well, it would be much more visible, but what's much more known is photographs of him and also the films. Both the films that he made, narrative films, but then also the films of his straitjacket escapes, which are still extremely compelling.
And I assume these films are all pretty much one shot to avoid the taint of trickery.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Especially the ones that we could call more like actualities that are out on the street.
There's a mystery about Houdini's death, and we'll talk about that and other aspects of the art and magic of Houdini when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Lauren Croys, and we are talking about the one and only Houdini. Now, there's an exhibit going on right now here in Madison at the Museum of Contemporary Art. Can you say something about this traveling show, Houdini Art and Magic?
Yeah, this is a show that originated at the New York Jewish Museum and combines a lot of ephemera and a lot of objects related to Houdini. It has his handcuff collection, for example, with works by contemporary artists who are responding to Houdini. So there's a really wide range of items there. I think they have over 100 objects on display, and it includes films of Houdini, also, as I said, his stuff, including his milk can escapes, a reconstruction of his Chinese water torture cell, and just a really wide variety of things.
Does anyone, a magician presumably, gone through the various Houdini tricks, you know, reproduced them? And if so, are there any that we just don't get how he did it?
Well, the museum actually struck sort of a deal with magicians that they wouldn't give away any secrets, so don't go expecting to figure out how to start your own magical sideshow. There are a bunch of online companies, or you can look at Houdini's books. A lot of them are now in the public domain if you want to figure out how to do some of his tricks. I think a lot of his tricks, though, are still... the general public doesn't know how they're done. They're the knowledge of a small set of magicians. And it's interesting because a lot of them aren't tricks, really. Like David Blaine.
More like procedures.
Yeah. Like David Blaine, for example, redid his Buried Alive. And he was just like buried alive. Like it was an endurance. Sort of more, we can think of it now as more as an endurance performance than it was a magical trick.
A bit of a daredevil act,
yeah.
I guess you'd say. You mentioned that there at the exhibit there are some artworks that respond to Houdini. I'm thinking in terms of literature where you've got Dr. O's Ragtime where Houdini becomes a character in the book. Are there other examples of sort of that show how Houdini becomes a basic cultural icon?
Yeah. I mean, you'll see at the museum, there's a wide range of different posters that he created for himself. He sued a lot of people for using his name. So that just shows sort of how widely known he was in that period. And I think even now, if you say Houdini, people know exactly who you're talking about.
Yeah. As we get into the mid-1920s, then, you say that his health is starting to go. I mean, I remember seeing you'd done in Key West one of these escape artists who was all chained up, and he was doing everything right literally on the sidewalk in front of you. And when he got out, which he did, even you notice even his eyes were bloodshot from all of the, you know, the stress, and his skin was kind of blue. I can imagine that Houdini, even after successful escapes, would get increasingly run down, as you say.
Exactly. And he does that for shows, like two shows a day for years and years, this constant pressure to escape. And he's not really willing to admit that he's getting older. He talks about retiring repeatedly, but then someone challenges him to do something, or he just feels challenged by these other magicians out there.
The irony is that he can't escape escaping.
Exactly.
He's trapped. He's trapped in his vocation. Mm-hmm. Well, and he dies on Halloween, which seems kind of, I don't know, fitting in a certain way. But can you tell us some of the, I guess, the legends that developed and what's now thought about what happened to him?
Yeah. So he dies, and it seems that he invited an artist, a student at, he dies, he's in Canada, he's at McGill University, and he's performed, and he invites a student backstage to do a sketch of him. And the student brings some friends, one of his frat brothers comes, and the frat brother is asking a bunch of questions of Houdini about how he does his escapes. And then at one point he says, I've heard that you can take any punch in the stomach. And this isn't really something that Houdini ever said. He never sets himself up as a punching bag, because that's almost like a sort of sideshow act that he's been trying to get away from. But he's never one to back down from a confrontation. So he says, oh, yes, of course. And he's reclining at this point. He's like on a couch because he's tired. He's in his 50s. And this college student just apparently wails on him, just like starts to punch him in the stomach. And Houdini doesn't have a chance to clench his stomach muscles. There's some debate. Maybe if he had been able to clench his stomach muscles, he would have been able to sustain all these blows. But that, combined with the fact that he's got appendicitis, which is another reason that he's not feeling that well, it ends up rupturing his appendix. And then he gets an infection.
Peritonitis.
Yeah, exactly. So he's taken to the hospital, almost recovers.
But he's got this peritonitis for some period of time, some days, and he's doing the act. He's got, a temperature of 104 or something like that, and he's still doing tricks.
Yeah, exactly. He's definitely he soldiers through many things. He doesn't like to admit, I think, when his body begins to betray him, when he can't actually escape his body. And he was going to do another one of these buried alive performances, so he ends up being buried in the coffin that he had ordered for this escape. And his wife, even though he doesn't believe in spiritualism, they make a pact that she'll try to contact him in the afterlife. So they have seances every year on Halloween for 10 years. And then she gives up. But I think people still have these seances on Halloween to try to contact Houdini.
She's famous for blowing out the perpetual candle that she had next to his picture and saying 10 years is long enough to wait for any man.
But and then there were legends that came up pretty quickly, too, that he had died in other ways, right?
Exactly. Some people think, and actually there was some plans afoot to disinter his coffin relatively recently to see if perhaps he had been murdered by the spiritualists, who were very upset that he was showing off all their tricks and trying to disprove their claims.
And I suppose even after he's buried, there's speculation he might escape or there's something. There's always this kind of, it's Houdini.
I'm sure
he's
there were a
surprise
lot of
us.
Jokes like, escape this one, his epitaph. Did he not die then, actually, while performing that trick or a trick? He didn't die during a trick.
No, it doesn't seem that he expired on the stage. Although that, I wouldn't put it past him because it would be like an extremely good show, but no. And you could almost argue, though, that since he gets buried in the coffin that he was going to perform the buried alive in, that he is in some ways, even in his death, performing this last trick, but he doesn't end up escaping.
So far as we know, I mean, nobody
So can. Yes, it's true.
Is there some sense that even though he had, you know, come to Wisconsin, even though he'd become famous and wealthy to some extent, does he always remain in a sense a freak or an outsider? I mean, you get this sense of Houdini the loner a bit when you read about him, that people come to watch him, there's spectacle, but there's something about him that never seems as if he really is one of the crowd.
I think he has a tough time being close to people because he has a tough time trusting people. And also this competitive aspect of him makes it difficult because he always wants to to prove to the person that he's trying to befriend that he's either as good as them because he's he doesn't have any formal education, but he wants to be respected by people with formal education. So he is sort of a bundle of contradictions that do make it, I think, make him into a bit of a loner. At times he'll claim that he was born in Appleton, Wisconsin, to try to get away from this idea of being an immigrant. Yeah.
And what intrigues you the most about him? I mean, you're coming to him from an art history point of view, from as somebody who studies turn of the century America and, you know, early modernism and so on. I mean, what intrigues you about Houdini?
I'm really interested in the way that he thinks about illusions and truth, and the way that he's interested in proving how things are done, and the way that he's sees himself almost as an expert on magic. This is a period in which people are sort of fragmenting expertise so that you become an expert in one thing and you know it really, really well. It's interesting to me that he takes that expertise in magic and then at the end of his life goes on this crusade against people who are using it for occult ends. So that for him, magic almost seems to be a kind of science or a scientific apparatus to push the body as far as it possibly can go. And he's not really interested in having a connection with another spiritual world. What he really wants is to analyze what we can do here and how seeing maps or doesn't map with believing. So as an art historian, someone who's so concerned about vision, to me that's extremely interesting.
So how did he make that elephant disappear in the Hippodrome?
I'm still not sure.
Elephant and the trainer, for that matter.
Yep. That was one of his most magical performances. He said he got the elephant from, I guess, P.T. Barnum's elephant Jumbo. It
well,
was
that's
like the
easy
grandchild
part.
Of Jumbo. Yeah.
So you got the elephant and then...
But then how did he make it disappear?
So what would it have looked like to someone coming to that show? What would they have seen happen?
Oh, to the elephant disappearance? He uses actually a giant ghost house, which we were talking about before, that screen that goes up around an illusion. So he puts an enormous... So they would have come to the Hippodrome and they would have seen this enormous elephant. I'm sure that Houdini would have told them many, many things about this elephant, about how hard it would be to make it escape, about how it was the how hard it would be to make it disappear, that it was the largest illusion ever. And then it would go behind this screen and then it would disappear. The screen would be removed and there would be no elephant back there. What's interesting is that a lot of people couldn't even actually see from the way they were sitting, so that he had to narrate what was happening to the audience. And the reactions of the ones in the front is what told all the other ones that there was no elephant there anymore. So it's not clear with that one if it was a sort of mechanical thing, like if the floor lowered and the elephant disappeared.
In the Hippodrome, exactly? Underneath that stage was a water tank.
Mm-hmm. Maybe he put it in the water. I mean,
it's... Did a little elephant dunking?
I don't know how long elephants could hold their breath.
Yeah, that would be the training. He had, I suppose, a lot of followers after he was gone in his wake. David Copperfield was one who was doing some of the same thing, and I believe actually owned some of the Houdini paraphernalia. Mm-hmm. But David Copperfield made the Statue of Liberty disappear somehow. It was on television, though.
Yeah.
I don't know if people in New York Harbor could actually see what was going on, but very much in the Houdini vein, some 70 years later.
Yeah, no, there's still a lot of interest in Houdini and a lot of interest in his magic. You can think about people like Penn and Teller, too, who take Houdini's escapes and sort of turn them towards comedy. A wide variety of magicians owe a wide debt to Houdini.
In a way, it's too bad there wasn't television, or do you think it's just as well that he didn't cross paths with television because it might have gotten in the way of some of his illusions?
Yeah, I mean, as we talked about, his film career doesn't go as well as he had hoped. So I sort of imagine that It may have been a similar thing with television. I mean, there's no telling how he might have adapted to a different time. But it is the case that there's something about the theatrical performance, and there's something about being physically in the same room with this great thing that's happening that is part of what made his work so powerful, that people could see it with their own eyes without any kind of intermediary.
And if somebody comes to Madison, goes to the exhibit at the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art, the Houdini Art and Magic, what will they come away being aware of about Houdini that they won't otherwise? What kind of impression?
I think it's almost the same thing. It's the fact that you can see things that Houdini actually touched, that you can see photographs of Houdini, that you can see these actual objects and still not understand at all how they're modified to make the his escapes possible, how the objects themselves kind of embody his act. There's also a lot of really interesting art. So I think that people will be able as well to see the way that contemporary artists are responding to Houdini's continuing legacy.
Well, it's a fascinating idea that contemporary artists would think about Houdini, let alone respond to his legacy. We'll find out how it plays out by going to that exhibit. Our guest has been Lauren Croyes, filling us in about the life and the illusions and the magic of, and the exposures, too, of others, of Houdini. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.